all about the pendants, baby.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
To start, press any key. Where's the any key?
Excuse me. I believe you have my stapler.
Welcome to We Are Technologies User Friendly with host Bill Sickens, technology architect.
Welcome back to User Friendly and welcome back to our new season. We have been on a break for a few weeks during the hot part of August, and it is good to actually be back here in the studio and able to record again. We've got a great fall coming up here. I mean, we've just got a ton of stuff that's on the agenda. A little bit of it, we're going to be covering the Marvel Superheroes Live, Superheroes Universe Live stage show this weekend, as a matter of fact, and we'll talk all about that next week. We had an interview with the producer director at the end of the season a few weeks ago, and if you would like to check that out, it's available online on our website, userfriendlyshow.com. Under the podcast section. We're also going to be covering the Snake River Comic Con. The producer of that has also been on the show in the past, and the event is actually planned here in a couple of weeks up in Idaho, and it's going to be really cool to see how that one comes out. I think that's going to be a really unique one just with some of the stuff they're planning there with the different things, Harry Potter themed room and a mermaid themed scenario and all kinds of stuff. So I can't wait to see what that is. We are going to have our new reporter, Brian, from the Salt Lake City area up there covering the show along with Warkey. And we're going to be introducing him today in a few minutes, see what he's going to be talking about with some of the stuff that's going on in his area. Also coming up is the SnafuCon in October, which is an anime comic con that's been going on for a number of years in Northern Nevada. And we're going to be there to check that out. And then the other one that is coming very soon is the big virtual reality conference in San Francisco. And we have backstage access to that to go down. We're going to be talking to a lot of their sponsors and finding out what's going to be new in the world of virtual reality. This next year, I think, is going to be the year that takes its own. We've seen all the new devices this year for the PlayStation, as well as the Oculus Rift system, Samsung, Google Daydream, which is now available on the Samsung 8, as well as the Pixel phones. All of these things are starting to be used commonplace, and not just for gaming. Virtual reality and its brother augmented reality are both things that are being used in the medical, business, and other vertical markets now. And there's a lot of different aspects and different things that can be done with it. So we'll be looking at it certainly from a gaming aspect, but also everything else that can go on there. Some of the lead developers and lead programmers in the industry will be there. Got a number of good interviews coming up on today's show. We're going to have Crit Killian from a number of different movies, including Beetlejuice, Star Wars, Star Trek, who has worked on building the sets. We've got an interview with him and a couple of other things. Mr. Movies joining us to talk about Stephen King's It. And we'll see what else is on the show today. This is User Friendly. This is Season 5. UserFriendlyShow.com. One User Friendly on Facebook. One User Friendly on Twitter. We will be back after the break. And welcome back to User Friendly. Check us out on Google Play and the iTunes Store. The podcast version of the show is available on both platforms, not just this week's, but last season and season one. And one of the questions that I've been asked, well, what happened to season two and three? Well, we don't talk about that. Actually, we can talk about that now. They're going to be posted towards the end of the fall. We're just cleaning some stuff up with them. The shows are out there. They were done as part of another broadcast, and we actually just got the rights to the material back about a week ago, so we are getting ready to put them out there so you can actually check those out as well, and I will be talking about them as soon as they're available online. But right now, season 1, 4, and our new season 5 are up, userfriendlyshow.com, one User Friendly on Facebook and Twitter, and Google Play and iTunes. Just search for the name of the show. Joining me is Gretchen and Jeremy. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello.
So what's in the news?
There's something going on with Equifax.
Yeah, there is. Equifax, which is one of the three big credit reporting agencies, got hacked. News of this broke on CBS on Thursday. I was involved with that and on our Friday morning show on KXL, talking about this when all of the information first started coming out.
So what exactly is Equifax?
Well, like I say, it's one of the three reporting bureaus. They started, Equifax is the oldest, starting in 1899. So it's been around for a little while. The original idea and what it does now are still basically the same thing. The way that they do it is different. When this started out, it was a way, if you got credit, like with your grocery store, it was based on your local reputation. And as society started to change and population started to increase, they started getting together to keep records of who was creditworthy. So that's the origin of this. Anyway, Equifax is one of three large companies that handle all of this. And the way they do it now, of course, is computer-based like everything else. And one of the things about this that's a little odd is if you go and apply for a credit card account, like at a store, you have a choice to do that. But the problem with the credit recording agencies is you don't really have a choice if you work with them or not. If you have any kind of credit, your history exists. They track your payments. They track all of that different type of information, addresses, your credit score, like the FICO score comes from them and all of that.
I see.
Does anybody regulate them?
Oh, they're regulated by the government, but okay. Like with banks and everything else, the regulation isn't that tight.
Oh, okay.
So how many records were affected?
But right now, the number that they're coming out with, which could increase, is 147 million,
wow.
Or about half the population of the United States.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So is this only like U.S. people, or does it affect anybody else?
They actually do keep records for a number of countries. They're saying that most of the world wasn't affected, but definitely clients in the United States and Canada. There's a few other places that it talks about, but those were primarily where the records came from.
Huh. So what can I do to protect myself from this?
Well, there's a couple of things to think about in line with this. First of all, there's a website that Equifax has put up. It's available at EquifaxSecurity2017.com. We'll go ahead and put that out on social media, so don't crash trying to write it down right now. But the website has the news and information on what's going on, what they found. Now, the other thing that's out there is the ability to enroll in complimentary credit monitoring. But the only issue with that is, and again, this was reported on CBS this morning, was that the accepting the terms and conditions to be able to enroll in the credit card monitoring or credit monitoring program causes you to waive your right to sue them or join a class action lawsuit.
So if you were hit really hard and you signed up for this thing and you have no recourse?
That's what the fine print says. Now, Equifax is saying that they're not going to enforce that. But as of the time that we're here talking about it, it is still in the terms and conditions. So we'll see if they remove it or not. But it is something to be concerned about. And something like that would definitely be a good idea to seek legal counsel. Now, in addition to the credit monitoring, taking steps with any hack to protect yourself are very important here. One of them is dealing with changing your passwords. And I know it's a pain in the neck to have a different password for each site and change them and have to remember all of that. But the problem is if they get access to one, it will allow you to access the other websites.
And it would be a domino effect. Yeah.
Exactly. Security Vault software, an example, is LastPass, and there's a number of them out there, might be a good thing for this. It randomizes your password, and then you just have a local password into the vault. It's a good way to remember them. The only downside to that is if you try to use another computer that doesn't have the vault installed, unless you can access that, then you wouldn't be able to access the site. So there's give and take. One of the other things, too, that's really important with this one is because a portion of the data that was leaked included driver's license numbers, home addresses, and other personal information is to update your security questions. And what that is when you sign up for an account, especially banking and financial things, you're asked, where did you go to high school or what road did you grow up on? What those questions are is to identify you in the event that you lose your password. But now, if it's something that was contained within the data that was leaked, they could actually go in and try to recreate the password after you change it. So upgrading the security questions and making sure they don't involve your driver's license number or address information, current and past, that is important.
Oh, wow.
A third thing that's very important to do is watch your accounts for unauthorized activity. And not just now, but on down the road. This stuff gets sold on the dark web. And this one, especially because you can't really change social security numbers and that type of thing, is going to be sold and resold for a while. So you may not see anything right away, but a couple of months down the road, something might happen. So it's a good idea to keep an eye on things just ongoing. And it's a good idea to do that anyway.
So obviously, if you have seniors in your life who are not exactly computer savvy, you probably should help them out.
Absolutely. Anything like that or anybody that, and it's not just seniors. There are many people that are not computer literate in this world,
yeah.
And you know, just go online and check their balance and might not know how to do these things, so they don't make the changes or even are aware of it. And it's important that any family members or anything like that give them a hand.
So I heard that there was another hack that's something to do with the power grid.
Yeah, this was a little earlier by about a day.
Uh-huh.
And this actually goes to a little bit longer story. The hack is called Dragonfly. Was the name of the situation. And this actually starts in 2011. And in 2011, this group tried to hack the power grid and was exposed by Symantec, who caught them. And they went underground for a couple of years. And they resurfaced about a year ago. It was Dragonfly 2.0, at least that's what they're being called, and did some things. The problem is now it's being reported that it looks like they might have been successful. There is some suspicion that this might have something to do with the whole Russian hack thing, because it's a very similar method that was used successfully a few months ago to take out the Ukrainian power grid, which shut down a number of different things. And you know, the scary thing, I think, with all of this is more than just the idea of they can black out and make things inconvenient, an extended blackout can really cause problems, but is the idea that they have successfully gotten into not the facility so far, but the control or network systems for a couple of nuclear operators here in the United States. And if they are able to breach past that security and eventually get into the control systems, then you can have much more catastrophic things like meltdowns or other situations that is a little bit more than just the lights going out for a couple of hours.
Hmm.
So those are our two hacks of the week.
Those are pretty sobering.
Yeah.
Very,
very much something to check out. And I'm going to go ahead and refer to our Friday morning on KXL, KXL.com. or userfriendlyshow.com. Go down to the bottom of the page, and there's some articles that talk about exactly what you can do to perfect yourself in both cases and give some more details on both of these things. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to User Friendly. Joining me on the set today is Brian Rollins, who will be joining the team as a correspondent reporter here in Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm super excited to work with you guys. From all I've heard, it's such a great opportunity.
Oh, it's going to be fun. I can at least say that honestly.
It has been a lot of fun.
Definitely had fun with you today. So, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I don't have much of a history with anything like this, but I'm excited to get into it. I've done some minor voice acting roles with a friend. I did a troll in a small video game, so I can do a bit of voices.
Well, you've worked with Warky, haven't you?
Yeah, I worked with Warky a lot. He's a good friend of mine. I've attended lots of cons. I love going to conventions here in Utah. I've been a Nintendo enthusiast all my life, since I got a Super Nintendo when I was 11. Me and my brother bought one from some stranger for about $100 before, like, Craigslist was a thing. Like, oh yeah, Super Nintendo, and I've had all the systems ever since, and just really enjoy that aspect of gaming.
Well, that is really cool. And I understood that you were a gamer and have played in with all of that.
Absolutely. And to the chagrin of my wife a little bit, but well,
that it is sometimes. So that sounds great. So I know you're going to be covering some of the different conventions going on in the Salt Lake area, and there's a lot of them from what I understand.
There are. There's more than a lot of realize. Like, there's Salt Lake Gaming Con every single year that focuses on, of course, games and gamers, and they do a lot of indie work. They've had Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft all at their convention.
I'm understanding that Salt Lake City is actually a bit of a technology hub, too.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. It's way more of a nerdy city than I knew. Like, Salt Lake Comic Con was the largest first-year con in the U.S.
Oh, wow.
They had more attendees than any other con in their first year, and so we're all nerds.
All right, well, we're going to be very much looking forward to having you on the show, and welcome to the team.
And we're
going to see what we get from all of the different things going on here.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
User-friendly, userfriendlyshow.com, and on social media, remember, there are other user-friendlies out there, but we are number one. One user-friendly on Facebook, one user-friendly on Twitter. We'll be back after the break.
Hey everyone, it's Warky once again with my convention report. So this last week, I got to go to the amazing convention Sabaton Con in Phoenix, Arizona, which was super hot, but also over the weekend, it was able to break its previous record for attendees. So with over 12,000 attendees this year, it was a seriously crowded event. But as always, it was also seriously just as fun. This is the 10th year for Sabaton Con, so it was an incredible time had by all. The con is run by the dynamic duo, as we so like to call them, Greg Fennell and his wife Stacy, two of the nicest people you'll ever have the joy of meeting. They run the con under the corporation Monkey Paw Entertainment. They have an incredible staff. I mean, talk about a con that'll bend over backwards to do anything for the guests. See, one of my requests was in the middle of a panel. I got kind of hungry. I was just begging for a burger from a particular fast food restaurant, let's just say. And by the time I was finished with my panel, the staff member had come back with a burger for me. I couldn't believe it. He brought it right from there. I was treated like a demigod. I don't want to say an actual god because, you know, there's still room for improvement everywhere, right? But I was treated like a total demigod for the duration of the con. And I certainly came away from there with nothing but extremely positive feelings. As for guests, they were amazing. Seriously amazing. They had an all-star roster of guests. Between Japanese guests like Yuko Miyamura, Sana, and the band Kaza, they also had American guests like Jeremy Lee, Dave Trosko, Ben Diskin, Morgan Berry, and more. And then they even had some on-camera guests from shows like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. They had Johnny Young Bosch, who played the Black Ranger, the ever-beautiful and always fun Carla Perez, who played Rita Repulsa. And of course, they had Robert Axelrod, who played Lord Zedd, in case you're a Mighty Morphin Power Ranger fan like I was. They even had more cosplay guests. They had Green Jello cosplay there, who did an amazing lineup. They had Sweets for a Sweet cosplay, and even more. I mean, they just had so many guests. It was a huge roster. But everyone contributed in a different way, and I think that really brought something special to all the fans. Seriously, meeting the guests was such a joy. It was such an incredible time. I couldn't imagine how much more fun it could have been had it been a different set of guests. I mean, it was incredible. Each one of them were so warm and so inviting and so kind and loving. And all of the fans there were so kind and loving. And just, I could not believe the amount of family it felt like. Because that was it. The whole entire time I was at the con, it felt like I was part of a family, something bigger than myself. And I had been to Sabaton Con one time before in 2013. And I had an incredible time then. But just to see how much it's grown and see so many fans who have grown up. It was rewarding and it was incredible. This entire con was just jam-packed with fun. If you didn't get to go this year, you guys really missed out. But as always, don't worry. Because you know what? They're going to be back next year. Just keep an eye out on sabatoncon.com. And then also we'll post a link in the show notes as well. For user-friendly, it's Warky.
I'm Gary Walcott. Welcome back to User Friendly. Today I'm reviewing the movie made from Stephen King's book, It. We all know Pennywise the Clown. He's one of author Stephen King's most creative villains. He's an It and able to shapeshift into other entities. Red balloons hanging in the air in Derry, Massachusetts tell you that Pennywise in his various forms are now preying upon children, feeding on their fears and killing them. Seven kids recognize the malevolence of the creature, and while being bullied by older kids manipulated by Pennywise, they vow to destroy it and end a reign of terror that's gone on for over a century. Director Andy Muschietti and the producers have gathered a great cast of young actors to play the kids, and they know that humor helps sell any horror concept, and they've given these kids some pretty playful and actually very funny dialogue. The cast is led by Jaden Lieberer, who shined in St. Vincent. He's the main character, Ben, whose brother Georgie is Pennywise's first victim. By the way, this kid was also exceptional in this year's little scene, The Book of Henry, and he's perfect again as the single-minded and very determined Ben. The other notable acting in the cast is from the very charismatic Sophia Lillis, who plays Ben's and the other kids' first love, Beverly Marsh. This young lady owns the movie and has one of those rare electronic personalities, I should say electric personalities, that promise a very bright future. Bill Skarsgård, who we recently saw in Atomic Blonde, does Pennywise, and like Tim Curry from the 1980 TV miniseries, he's pretty good. However, Muschietti, as did the miniseries producers, misses a chance to create a really great horror movie villain. Now, King's description of Pennywise demands a character made up more like Heath Ledger's The Joker. A more frightening portrayal would have Pennywise being clowny-looking, but disheveled with smeary makeup and lizard-like eyes. Now, King loves Muschietti's version, and so will most of you. It's one of those cathartic bully films that has you remembering just how much it sucked to be a kid when bullying wasn't a politically correct no-no. Hardcore fans will find the story not all that true to the book, Purists will also note it's just half the story, so look for part two if this does well at the box office. And since horror movies these days pretty much suck, it should be a big hit. As for me, I found It to be passable, but It is a bit drawn out, and It is not all that scary, nor is It all that interesting. I say, see it if you're a fan of horror or a King fan. I'm Gary Walcott.
Welcome back to User Friendly. This is Jeremy Winkler and Gretchen Winkler and our special guest, Crit Killen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming. So we heard you've done a lot of science fiction stuff and worked in a lot of movies. So we'd like to ask you how you got started in working in movies.
Well, I think to define me when I was younger, and of course when I say younger, this was back in like 1980. I was in college, and I was the artistic type who didn't really fit in.
We know that. Yes,
you know that. You know, it's like you have all this energy and stuff that you want to do, and so because I could draw to some degree, not fantastic, but I could draw. It's like, well, then you need to go and sign up for art classes, and so I went. And it turned out, though, that what I was doing was drawing bowls of fruit and, you know, a Bambi by the stream, and it just wasn't me. I mean, nothing against those great works of art that people do like that, but for me, I wanted to do something exciting. So when I'd get an assignment in class, you need to do something with light and shadow, I would draw Conan the Barbarian, you know, cutting, you know, down something. And so I was constantly berated in class, and you know how the school goes.
They want specific classical objects,
right? So I was also on the track team in college, and so I'd hurt my leg. I met a guy when we were both getting treated in the physical, whatever that is, you know, room where you do all that.
The therapy room.
That is it. Yeah, therapy for sure. And he said that he was doing a thing called industrial design, so that where they drew, you know, all kinds of different mechanical things and just created products that sounded better. So I switched over to that program. But, you know, I brought myself with me, which meant I didn't really fit after a while in that as well. And to compound things, my teacher didn't like to teach. So he didn't like to be there. So he would go on these research projects where he would take, you know, a sabbatical, and he would have someone else teach that semester for him. Hmm. Well, it just so happened that he'd met a man while flying to Japan who was a movie producer. And so when we came to class back after the break, came back to school, we had this teacher who we knew we weren't going to have our regular teacher, but this guy was Douglas Trumbull, and he's known as the Dean of Special Effects. He's 2001, he's Blade Runner. I mean, he was it, you know, probably more patents on technology, at least camera work back then, not digital, but... and so he then announced, "Hi, I'm Doug Trumbull, I'm going to teach your class this semester."
Oh, that must have been.
So, yeah, it was really amazing. And so he brought a script and explained to us that you break the script down and you design all the stuff in it, you know, so that if Luke Skywalker's going to go off in a speeder, what does that speeder look like? And so you just go through the script and you pick something and you design it. So everyone goes through the script and starts picking out their things. And so I read the script, not really knowing what a script is. And it was Moby Dick in outer space hunting the white whale in black hole. And I'm like, wow, that's really cool, except hold on a minute. I didn't think you could go into a black hole, right? And don't they crush stars or planets and stuff? So I'm like, now here's me coming and bringing out my difficult side, and I'm saying, hey, I can't do this because it doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
And they're like, well, that's the script. Pick something, go. And it's like, I can't. So he's like, well, I don't know what to tell you. Doug Trumbull, here he is, movie producer. Here's this great opportunity, and I'm kind of blowing it. And so I remember walking home, watching TV, and I saw this thing on whales, and it dawned on me, oh, my gosh, because whales beach themselves, you know, dolphins. Mm-hmm. I thought, what if in this story I could add into this thing where maybe a whale beached itself on the shores of a black hole, and Captain Ahab, out in his spaceship sometime prior to the story, sees this whale, goes down, takes it, brings it back to his laboratory or on his ship, and makes a spacesuit from the body parts of a whale that lives in a black hole. So that, right, if the whale can live there and you made a spacesuit out of it, you could go in there. Now, that made sense to me. The only problem was that wasn't in the script. So I didn't know that much about, I didn't know that you weren't really supposed to tamper with, so you're a writer.
Yeah.
I'm going to tamper with your novel, with your story. I just thought, okay, this is cool. He'll love it. He'll be really happy that I'm doing this, and I have found something that I can do. I mean, I kind of knew because it wasn't in the script, I better do it sort of on the sly. So I'd work after, you know, after everyone would go to another class, I would come in the evening and stuff. But so I kind of Kobayashi Maru'd the whole thing before the Kobayashi Maru story came out. I mean, I
like it.
I can't remember when it came out. But so I rewrote the script and added in my part to it about the whale being beached on the shore of the black hole, and I began to make a spacesuit, three-dimensional piece that I wanted to contribute to the movie. So we had the review. End of semester, everybody did the review. I wanted to go last because I figured I was going to get in trouble anyway. And so Doug's there, and he's got his assistants and everybody there from L.A., and I come in, and I'm supposed to have drawings. I have one drawing, but I have my friend who's a bodybuilder walk in the room wearing this suit made from whale parts. So the eye would be the lens, right? The veins would be all the air tubes and all that kind of stuff, and the bone and the skin. So in walks my friend wearing this suit, and Doug gets up, just stops right there, gets up, walks over, takes a look at it, takes the helmet off, looks inside of it, and he said, "Would you like a job in Hollywood?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Of course, that'd be great, man." He's like, No.
Fabulous.
He's like, "No, I mean, I fly out tonight. I'd like to see you tomorrow, and I'd like to have you take and now, you know, take what we've done and match it to this type of look." Because it was kind of, wasn't totally biomechanical, but kind of biomechanical, the bone and everything. So I was like, "You mean like be there tomorrow?" And he's like, "As soon as you can be there, you've got a job."
That is awesome.
So that's how, so here I am in college, kind of the loser student that can't quite find his way. And that moment that I was able to take that and have that one idea of the whale being out and making that work in my mind. At first, I'm not too excited that you have changed the script, but because it did fit in so well that it kind of was overlooked like everything. It's like, you know, hey, you're never going to work in this town again until we need you, and then everybody's friends again. So, so that worked out, and I went to L.A. and went to his studio, and then, of course, him being Doug Trumbull, it was all of his associates and everybody that he would introduce me to were at his level, so it made it a lot. I kind of worked from the bottom up. I just, when that project was done, he's like, "Well, hey, I know they're doing this project over here with Mark Stetson." He was one of the Academy Award winners for Lord of the Rings, I believe, and other things. I mean, they just worked on everything. So I would kind of just go to these other studios.
That really opened the door for you to do other projects and be exposed to these other people.
Exactly. I mean, because the way it kind of works in L.A., or the way it did work in L.A., is that you work on a movie, you're going to work on this movie, and when that's done, they don't keep you on staff. There's no more money for that project. So then you hear from, say, "Hey, so-and-so, they're doing Terminator." So, you know, you go over and see if there's anything open still. So it opened the doors because he could then call, or I would go and say, "Hey, I just finished up at Doug Trumbull's. I just finished with Steven Spielberg." Right? And so that name, that brought you right into whatever project was working. So
that old saying about knowing people is actually very true.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
There are a lot of times when you nurture the relationship more than you actually work the project. You know, it's one thing to do a great job and make great things and whatever you're designing or building or doing, but that relationship, you know, even if you think it should be shot better, even if you think the script should be changed, most of the time you should work that relationship more than you're working the product. Because in the end, the product might be great, but if they hate you, they're never going to call you back.
Yeah. And there's some really good relationships, I think, that can be made there. I've started working on my own projects, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Really amazing people. So there were some other films that we've heard that you worked on as well.
Yeah, we have Star Wars 1, The Phantom Menace with George Lucas.
Right.
With Big Trouble in Little China, which was one of our favorite films.
What did you do on that one?
So we worked on all of the plant and all that motion. So I have a kind of a mechanical brain. When you back then in the day before computers, you had to, your whole value almost came from being able to figure something out. Mm. How do you make that fly across the room? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we would make a laser beam by making like a really bright yellow rubber band. We'd pour out latex, right? Be bright and shiny. And then we'd pull it across the room, 20, 30 feet.
Oh, wow.
You film it in reverse, and it looks like the beam is shooting out, right?
That is amazing.
So it's just, how do I figure out how to make a something work? And so with Big Trouble in Little China, it's like, you know, it's a plant. It's a plant that moves, and all of its little, I don't know if they're branches, but whatever our flowers and plants do. It's just, how do you make them move? Do you put a cable up there? Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, is it a pull cable? Is it radio controlled? I mean, how is this going to work? So basically, I worked a lot in things like that little thing that had to work. You figure out those kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. So,
cool. What did you do in Phantom Menace?
Robot design. I mean, if film is anything, it's a collaborative effort, right? And right. So, in the beginning, it's like they would send out to all of the creative people, or, you know, people would hear this or this, have a friend there, and it would be like, okay, we want a whole bunch of different designs of robots and things like that. So they would send, you know, you'd get they want, like the cantina scene. So you mm-hmm. would just design and send it in and collaborate back and forth and this and that. And then they didn't work on it then again for another year, yeah. Right? So it would be like you're doing it and creating this and making it and making the maquette, the little pop-up things and stuff like that. And so so what we would do is create all those things and then see how far that design would go before either they hired you or they just in-house took and meshed all those ideas together.
Right.
You know, so
awesome. Okay, so we also heard about Total Recall.
Total Recall. You know, I had a good friend, Rick Lazzarini. He did the chest buster. It was a little man that lived in his chest.
Yeah.
And so through Rick, there were all kinds of other pieces from set pieces, all those pipes. I don't know if you remember. I mean, they were on Mars. Mm-hmm. It was Mars, right? And all the stuff that you see in there had to be built, but it was built to a large degree in miniature. So, and when I say miniature, it would probably be maybe Kmart size, right? So if a pipe's going to be 20 feet in diameter, it'd be like 3 or 4 feet. So we were still working with large pieces, but it was a lot of the Mars set, the interior, all of those buildings and everything were all built in miniature, but they were large, large miniatures. So the building that should be castle, 10-time castle size, might be the size of a small house. Mm-hmm. That's a miniature.
Oh, wow.
But
no idea.
Yeah, so yeah. They would still be, it'd still be pretty large. So
that's fabulous.
That's what we did in that.
All right, and the last one I have that it was in my collection readily available was Beetlejuice.
Well, Beetlejuice, I'll tell you, we had no idea Beetlejuice was going to be Beetlejuice. When you saw it on paper and had it explained to us, mm-hmm. It was like, why would I want to work on that movie? I mean, it just sounded ridiculous. And what's funny is that I was doing Robot Jocks at the time, which obviously very few people have heard of because it wasn't maybe as good as other films. So it was like Robot Jocks seems so incredible. These mm-hmm. robots, Transformers, we just thought it was going to be fantastic. And Beetlejuice just seemed like, why would I want to work on that? But I had a number of friends working on it, and they kept saying, you know, calling me saying, hey, we're about to start. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. All these little things in there, you'll be able to figure out how to make the mouth move and all that. And I kept turning it down and turning it down. And then finally, my friend Pete Gerard called and said, look, you got to do this movie with us. It's going to be fantastic. Well, we didn't really know who Tim Burton was. Michael Keaton wasn't cast yet, so mm-hmm. Oh, hey, come do this movie, Michael. And Michael Keaton was, I mean, they were both popular, but that movie, I think, really began to launch him. But he wasn't even cast, so you didn't have even that to draw on. It's just that it had a lot of mechanical weird things in it, so it should be fun with all your friends working. So about the third time, I think I turned it down 3 times, and then Pete called, and I said, okay, we're going to finish with Robot Jocks anyway, so mm-hmm. I'll come on over. So we went over there. Robert Short, Bob Short, and Barb Slifka, they headed up the whole effects team there, and we just began to literally make everything. There were set pieces we didn't work and build too much, but everything else, I mean, from the shrimp and the shrimp finger hand.
The shrimp fingers. Yeah.
from that to the flat man that goes by to...
He was amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, fantastic. My friend Mike worked on that a lot, but we just had everything there. The sandworm, that when the handrail turns into a snake,
yeah,
that was we actually built that snake, and that snake was probably a foot and a half in diameter, and it was big and large to do that scene. But we just made a snake head that looked scary, and then when they cast Michael Keaton, they said, well, we want the snake head to look like Michael Keaton.
Oh.
Well, we've spent, I don't know, $250,000 making this big old snake.
Oh, wow.
And there's no time and budget now to go back really and change it. So they brought in a stop-motion animator who then did that snake. Otherwise, it was going to be our snake. But they needed it to look like Michael so that they could identify. Because part of Beetlejuice, the story originally, is that he would take different incarnations,
mm-hmm.
right? So when he was as a snake, he still needed to be identifiable as Michael Keaton, the snake, or Beetlejuice, the snake, as a snake. And our thing just looked like a snake. So it was too confusing that maybe you wouldn't follow the story. So we'd built that. I mean... the little preacher guy, I mean,
he was adorable.
Well, originally his mouth opened, I don't know how to explain that, but it just opened like this, up uh-huh. and down. It didn't hinge the way our mouths.
Oh,
they,
oh, okay.
They thought that would look really, really neat.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is there's nothing on planet Earth whose mouth really works like this.
Yeah.
So no, That
would have been a very interesting appliance.
Yeah, it looked really strange. So we'd built all this fantastic apparatus to make that work, and it looked terrible. So we had to go back and rebuild it.
Oh,
oh wow.
So he could just speak like a normal human being, which he wasn't really a normal human being.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we just had everything in that of all those little things, the model, the miniature, it was the shark, the guy sitting in, what was Judgment Room or where was that? Was
oh, that was the limbo, oh, the waiting the room limbo in Limbo. That scuba room. Diver who'd been eaten
yeah.
by the shark.
Yeah, so you made that. I mean,
that's amazing.
The Char Man. In fact, can I tell you this story?
Sure.
So we're working on Beetlejuice, and I'm doing something. My friend Max Cervantes, he did most of that head, that well, probably all of that head. The carousel hat with the animals, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he was working on that, and, you know, everybody's helping everybody else do this, that. And my one friend, Dave Atherton, that was there, came back from the set and said, hey, man, they need somebody to go over and blow the smoke through the tube. Because remember, in the waiting, or the lady with the...
Juno
with Juno, the slit yeah. throat, right? Well, so... They needed someone to blow that smoke in that tube. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't smoke, man. And he's like, that doesn't matter. You know, just get over there and just blow the smoke in there. And I'm like, I got to finish up with Max, or I've got to finish doing the shrimp hands. I don't know what I was doing, but I got to finish that. And he's like, dude, get over there. And I'm like, I can't. Someone else go. And he asked someone else, who I can't remember his name right now. They ask him to go. He goes over there. He blows that smoke. I think, I don't know if he took a drag on a cigarette, blew it through the tube, comes out the her cut in her throat,
mm-hmm.
and nobody thinks anything of it, right?
Right.
Well, because she speaks, right?
Oh.
You got it, right?
Yeah.
That's a SAG part.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember exactly. I just remember him telling me that Beetlejuice had been out for, I don't know, a couple weeks. It could have been a month or something, and he had gotten $50,000 in residuals on that payment from doing that.
Oh, my goodness.
That's amazing.
So talk about missing the moment, right? Yeah. Missing that opportunity. It's like, I'm too busy to go over there. If I had known or thought through that, it'd be like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Hey. And he got residuals. I don't know how long they last, but, you know, they keep going.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting as I think back on opportunities that, you know, you...
That one, you know, accidentally misses. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. That yeah. would have made a huge difference.
I was the guy holding the wall panel. I get, you know.
I get residuals.
Yeah. It's like, I get residuals.
Yeah. That's me blowing the smoke, man.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it was just a lot of fun things like that, that we just back and forth to the set making things. I mean, the carousel and the hands and the arms and just all the stuff that's in Beetlejuice. It's so fantastic.
And we'll be right back with Crit after these messages. And we're back with Crit on User Friendly.
Now, so. I heard a rumor that you had like a special keepsake from that movie.
Yes. So, you know, Michael, putting all the stuff on him was just hellacious for him. It was,
yeah, I bet.
You know, yeah, it was hot and heavy
yeah.
and difficult. So, I don't know why him and I kind of got along, and so I stayed most of the time to watch after the props that he was burdened with or whatever. So at the end of the movie, the business cards that are sitting on the table, the Beetlejuice business cards, he gave me the one that he had, and so I kind of brought it with me today. But it's the Beetlejuice card that...
Oh, that's cool.
And I don't know if I... Do I hold that up at all?
Might as well. I mean, one of the cameras will get to it. One of them will get it. Amazing.
But yeah, so he gave that to me.
I'll hold that up.
Yeah, hold that up.
Zoom in on that.
And, and, you know, I didn't really know that it had much of a significance. And back then, I mean, you didn't have cell phones, so you didn't take millions of pictures. Mm-hmm. They didn't like you to take pictures anyway. I mean, you can always sneak them with your phone nowadays. But you didn't have so much of a collectible mindset like you do nowadays. I mean... Planet Hollywood, I think, became the first big thing where there were props that came out of movies. So we had all kinds of props. We did Freddy Krueger, and I did the one where it was a giant Freddy Krueger, and he ate Patricia Arquette. You remember that one? I'm not sure. Yeah. Dream Warrior. I think it was Dream Warriors. So I worked on Dream Warriors, and when we were done, they didn't even want the Freddy snake. I mean, this thing was 12 feet long. I mean, it was big enough for you to sleep inside.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, we just took, you know, they said, yeah, we're just going to throw it out. So.
I'm always surprised when I hear things like that because Jeremy and I, we build our costumes.
Oh, uh-huh.
And there's like little props. And for us, they're like little pieces of artwork.
Right.
So I would imagine that people who are the designers and the prop masters, these are little pieces of artwork, and to think that it gets thrown away is like, oh.
Yeah, because you do. I mean, you spend so much time. I mean, you're making it. You're living in this. You're not living in a fantasy, but you're kind of living in this amazing moment where you're going to make something that's going to be on this 50-foot screen, and everybody's going to see it. And you just take such pride in it, and you're so excited when you do it. When I was working on Star Trek VI, I believe, I think it was Benjamin Franklin's glasses they brought out from the Smithsonian for me to copy because that's the look they wanted.
Yeah.
And so I had one day, you know, under lock and key to replicate these glasses for, I think Kirk puts them on.
Yeah,
right?
There is a scene there, yeah.
So, yeah, right? So here you have the originals, and then I'm supposed to make an exact copy of this original.
Wow.
You know, and go, which one is the real one?
Yeah.
So, but I took such pride in that because it's like, I know that there's going to be a scene where he puts them on and everyone's going to see those and you're not going to think much about it, but I'm going to sit there and go, wow, you know, I burned myself six times trying to solder those things or whatever it was. And
Do you ever wonder what happens to some of these things?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I wonder. I don't know where those are. You know, those kind of movies, you're not allowed to take pictures, and you know, and they don't give you, you know, those bigger studio movies, you're not gonna take any extra pulls out of a mold or anything,
right.
Or you know, they don't want you measuring stuff. You know, make a Klingon ship. You know, it's like, oh, here's all these. Maybe I can.
Can I get the parts home?
Yeah, you know. It's like, oh, I didn't pour enough resin in this one, so I'm gonna throw it out. But maybe it finds its way into my bag. But so those are really difficult ones. But I know some guys have big prop collections, but some of those really neat things like that, I haven't seen. That's why I was excited in time, as people like yourselves have let me know, since I'm kind of old school, that these things like this Beetlejuice card, they're worth money. I mean, people love this kind of stuff. They love the original copy of this or something, and it's like, oh, the things that I have had, the Chucky doll that I gave away, you know, to my nephew because, like, you know, he's having a bad day. Take the Chucky doll, you'll love it. Or, you know what I'm saying, things that you just go, oh, my gosh, if I had today. When we did Star Trek VI, I think it was The Undiscovered Country, they said that was going to be the last movie. So we're going to give everybody a shirt that's got the original little pin thing, and original this, and it's because it's the last one. And so, do I know where any of that is today?
Mm-mm.
No, I don't know where that is. Aww. So, just of course, they've made other movies, so whatever. Yeah.
But still,
I would have had an original shirt, which I had an original shirt, which I'm sure I couldn't fit in, but it would still be nice.
It'd still be yours.
it's all those things, like all the photos, all the movie posters, all the action figures and the dolls and the things from every film. I mean, you'd have to have a warehouse.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and that's another side of it. Like you say, I mean, even after the film is done, a lot of times the toy makers will hire the special effects artist to at least help them with like a maquette type thing in which they can then scan or have, you know, make the an actual toy from. So it's kind of fun to actually pick up a dual type of role like that, I guess.
So you have other opportunities as a consultant to the toy people.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool.
Because that you might have been the person who actually made that in the first place. And so, you know, that's who better to go to than the person who made it in the first place. So
that's pretty awesome.
Do you like have any advice for people who want to go into the industry? You know, any?
I think, you know, I mean, I had a unique situation where I had that movie producer come to my class, and that's not going to happen probably very often.
No.
But the nugget of something that I got out of that experience is and I call this the Samson moment. And we have Samson moments happen to us. You know, Samson, he did everything wrong in his life. If you remember that story, he had long hair and he was really strong and he was supposed to do something. But he just squandered his whole life. But in the end, he was able to, when he had to do what he had to do, he was able to do it. And so by having that experience in college with Doug Trumbull, what I realized is that you need to have at least one something. You'd have some, be the best fake fur suit sewing specialist, or be able to handle a lightsaber better than anybody else. You have to have something that is unique and special, that is your moment. And I don't care what it is. It could be, and now it's digital if you're going to talk about effects or a lot of filmmaking. But be the best recording artist, sound guy or whatever. I think the advice would be find something that is that you're best at or can be as good as you can be, so that someone who's looking or a project that's looking, and every project is looking for somebody to bring something unique and special.
Yeah.
And so I guess that experience taught me that I did that thing completely backwards. I rewrote someone else's script not knowing it. I couldn't conform to what was there. I had to be, you know, like the Kobayashi Maru. I couldn't conform to it. I had to be. But that thing, that action is what made me get noticed for some type of special.
It was your passion people. Coming passion. Through. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when you have something, you're passionate about it. I mean, if you like watercolor, if you're passionate about it, then something is waiting to display your talent and your special gift. And I think that would be my advice, is it doesn't matter if you're not good at anything else. I wasn't good at any, I mean, I was barely in school, And yet that moment came, and it wasn't dependent on, was I a good person? It wasn't dependent on he's a straight A student, he deserves it. You know, I didn't have any qualification except maybe that passion. And that this one thing I can do.
Right.
And I think that drives it, because every business, every CEO, every movie is waiting for that thing to come into their life to make their project, whatever it is, better.
Well, I think you've given us some good advice, you know, and
so
for everybody else out there, you know, there's a lot of dreamers who still want to make their mark or just share their special talent. Mm. And
I think so. And I think you get discouraged because Hollywood is a big, tough brass dome trying to get into.
It does seem very scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I went there, so even though I went there with the invitation of Doug, we didn't have cell phones. He wrote his phone number on a piece of paper.
Oh, wow.
He said, I'm in Santa Monica. Just call me when you get here. I drove to Santa Monica. I called him on the phone from a payphone. I get the secretary.
Oh, wow.
The secretary says, do you have an appointment? And I said, no, I met Doug and he wants me to come to work. She says, well, if you don't have an appointment, I can't put you through. And hung up. So I was like, how did that happen? So I called again, same thing. I slept in my car that night because I really didn't have any money. I mean, I was just a college student. I woke up the next day. I called 3 or 4 times. Same thing. You have to have an appointment. Oh, how do I get an appointment? You have an agent. No, I don't have an agent. How do you get it? I did this for 7 or 8 days.
48 steps.
Oh, wow.
Sleeping in my car.
Persistence. There's the other lesson.
Sleeping in my car. And I knew every homeless guy because I had a little bit of money. So I would eat. I would buy peanut butter and jelly, and I would make sandwiches. And we'd all sit. And I sit on the curb, me trying to figure out how do I get through this secretary to Doug. And, you know, and day after day, 7, 8 days, 9 days maybe. And I was about to leave because I was about out of even gas money to get home. Mm-hmm. I've come to Hollywood under this big fanfare of this guy who loves me, and I've I'm as close to my goal as I can be, and never felt further away in my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was about to just say, all right, I'll go home. I didn't really quit school, so I could go back. And then even though everyone would laugh at me as a failure, they wouldn't know it. I just said I missed about a week or so of school, right? I'm sitting there on the curb, and I remember he had an assistant who was from England, and Liz Kern, she became a producer later. I just remember her accent was so cute. So she'd come into class and she'd ask us how we're doing, and we'd try to get her to talk so she could talk along. And as I sat on the curb after, you know, over a week of failure, I remembered, oh, Liz Kern, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I dare do this. Can I do my British accent?
Certainly.
We're not going to stop you.
So I get up off the curb. I go to the payphone. I'm sleeping in the Rouse parking lot, Rouse grocery store.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. Parking lot. So I go to the payphone at Rouse, and I put in my quarter, and she answers the phone like she's been doing multiple times a day for over a week. Hi, Trumbull Studios. And I went, oh, yeah, hello. I wonder if you could help me out, love. I'm going to be flying back to England today, and I've got some papers I want Doug to look over. Could you put me through, please? And she goes, yeah, sure, no problem. Puts me right through. And why? Because everyone with an accent is important, right?
Uh-huh, yes, of course.
And I don't know why I thought
that. And everybody loves British accents.
And everybody loves British accents. I'd never done a British accent. I'm just going on what I heard her and when we were in class talking. And she put me right through. Doug answers, hi, this is Doug. Uh-huh. And I'm like, Doug, hey, it's Crit. I'm here. And he's like, where have you been? I thought you were going to be here like a week ago. And I'm like, well, I was, but your secretary wouldn't put me through. And, you know, a few things were said here and there. And that moment actually is when I really started working because I was there for over a week with what we're talking about, this difficult brass dome that is Hollywood and how you get in there. Even with an invitation, I almost didn't get in there. So it is daunting, but I can tell you the best thing to have is your singular gift or point of view that you can put out there in writing or whatever. So
that is amazing.
Well, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you inviting me here.
And we'll be back right after the break.
Well, it's great to be back. What a show. I mean, we took a break, but the hacks sure didn't. Make sure that you do check on your accounts and things, because it is actually kind of an important issue. And this breach actually has the potential of being a lot more catastrophic than a lot of the other ones. I want to thank our guest today on the show again, Crit Killian. What an interview. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. Jeremy and Gretchen interviewed him, but I did have a chance to meet him on the set that day, and he was just a wonderful person. It was absolutely incredible talking about some of the different things he's done with Star Wars and Star Trek. And his first movie, I believe, was Beetlejuice, and he's just worked on a ton of just fun projects that are out there. And it was really cool. Well, this weekend we're going to Marvel Universe live. I have never seen a live superhero show before, but from talking to the producer a few weeks ago, it sounds like it's going to be incredible. We're going to tell you all about it and everything else that's coming up this fall. This is User Friendly. I am Bill Sickens, userfriendlyshow.com. Jump on, let us know what you want to hear. This is User Friendly, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly is copyright 2017, User Friendly Media Group, Inc., all rights reserved. Music used under license. Opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of User Friendly Media Group, Inc., or this station.